That's right.
What was it like?
The name, Eustace Main, just the way it breaks the road.
Where did you come to Alaska?
1922.
What did you do in Maine before you came to Alaska?
Oh, I know. I had my hand in the Columbus on the garden, hunting with fish paddles, lumberjack. Principally, I was a white water man for the lumber companies. I came down the Yukon in the canoe that fall and landed at Circle. That was a wild and lonely place. Not been, not many people there, but it was very remote. When we walked from there across the Fairbanks, well, that was up the road. They had the road as far as Chattanooga. That was a steep highway. Rick was working on the moose. A few years ago, it used to be terrible, although I think there were hundreds of thousands of them everywhere. But the world didn't bear the moose so much. They'd been mostly on caribou. But it's been born in our new year observation that the wolves kill a ratio of 5 cows to 1 bull. That's why I hate these cow moose season of the hunters. Because the wolves take care of any other population that might be on cows. The cows have hard going in the beginning in February. They're heavy with calf at times. Easy prey for wolves. Then during the summer and the beginning of the fall, they have their calves with them. And they'll stop and fight for the calves, and they will get them. The bear, the black bear, they're vicious too. They take a terrific toll on the calf crops in the summer. And in fact, the one moose pasture that I find over about 3 times a week with the male. And I had a preacher in me that could verify this, or, you know, I'm telling the truth. There were 3 bears in the meadow. They had 5 cow moose corralled, and they went along that meadow. The cows hadn't had their calves yet, but they were about to have them. And the bears were laying for the calves, and then the cow moose went around the meadow. The bears were laying. So we went down and we chased 1 bear out of the meadow, a big one. Took a couple of good buzzers and combed his hair real good to get him out of the meadow. And while I was chasing another one to get him out of the meadow, the other one came back. So it was a losing game. The preacher got sick and so I had to quit. We went 5 miles an hour over across the river in another big meadow, and there's 2 bears over there. I had 2 cows corralled and held them right there. And they held them right for 2 days too because I watched them. Now, that's what's going on in the woods all the time with your game. Every day, 24 hours a day. Wolves, I know that 6 wolves will take the biggest bull moose in his tightness trim at the best time of the year for him to fight, and 6 wolves will take him. And I've got a hunch that 3 will take him, too. Maybe 2. But 3, I think, will do it. But I know it's 6 will. You'll see it done. I circled around overhead and watched them kill moose. And caribou was fine, too.
When did you join the Alaska Game Commission?
27th March.
You started flying from here
across the Alaska? Yeah, I started flying in 29. And I started doing 28, but I didn't get going until 29.
I remember you telling me that the moose were all moving north. That's the first time I ever heard of moose going north the way it sounds in the picture.
Yeah. There's always been moose up there, I guess. It's not like it's found off from Eskimos. There's been a few moose on the Colorado River and on them tributary creeks like the Valley of the Willow, the Picnic, and the Willow Creek over there, and there the Canning. All of them little valleys that had willows and alders in them usually had 1 or 2 moose hanging around, and in some instances, take a time. The best concentration was between the mouth of Killick on the Colorado and the mouth of Anacortes. There were quite a few moose in there. But the Navy just went to bail about every 4 or 5 years, and I guess when they went in there, they just about cleaned them out, because there was no place for Moose to hide, there was no place for him to go. The willow was the tallest willow, he was, the Moose would be as tall as the willow was, and it could be even seen. And there wasn't much food, except on the willow. In 55, I was up there all summer long, flying the coast today. And there was quite a lot of moose there then, and I saw them out in the tundra feeding out on lakes. And they were at least 15, 20 miles from the nearest willow bush, which was good to be no more than knee high anyway when you did get to them. Where they stayed, I don't know, because you go there a dozen times, you wouldn't see them, but it's feeding time, and see them out in the lakes. They must have been hiding somewhere. And speaking about feeling going north, when I come out that fall, the weather was kind of bad and I was kind of tripping the thunder a little bit. I'm up and coming through Santa Cruz Pass, big boy. He didn't turn around, did he? He turned around up and down there, went right over and down through the pass and kept that on going down there. Down here on the field.
What is it?
Good game that
way. Pressure, less pressure?
It could be low pressure, yeah. The waves at that time were awful thick on the kayak hook, and they are, yeah, too. There's too many of that. There's lots of waves over there. It's a heavy roof population. And the last 4 years has been a terrific increase in the bear population over there. Usually, what you see flying across the country in the line of bears, black bears, you see the size of two cubs. Ooh, what the hell, you see them in three? That's normal. You don't see very many of them in three. But the last 3 or 4 years of flying up there on the main runs, there was a lot of tons of them over there that had four cubs. You're scaring the bear, you could just see the bears increase. Next year it'd be twice as many bears as one year before. And they get the dog down 50 of the loose and they into everything, and they get so they weren't afraid of anybody. They were hungry. And when they land on the old field at Hog River, that was a big field. And I'd have a load of meat, maybe. And it'd take them 20 minutes sometimes to get from the camp out there with a truck. Well, I didn't even dare open the door of the airplane, and bears were just sitting all around the airplane, storing that meat. Then I'm going to buy the sugar one day and get out in the middle of the field and was eating it. And I was trying to land, and they couldn't drive them away from there. So they finally had to shoot them and drag them off the field and go out and land. Oh, and they're nuisance. There's too many of them anyway, and just as a sidelight on that, back in Maine, they had a bounty on bears there for I don't know how many, when I was old enough to know anything about it. I knew there was a bounty on bears, because I used to collect it every now and then. I used to go out and do it with bears. And they took that bounty off about 10 years ago, but they didn't put no protection on them. Now they got the many bears up there, they don't know what to do with them. Back in Maine, where they got population. They don't know what to do about those bears. They don't like to kill them off, there's no protection, whatever. No bounty, but there's no license required to shoot them, there's no limit on them, and there's no season. You shoot them anytime you want to. And they still got the money. So I don't see any real need of protecting black bears. Because you're going to have too many of them, whatever you do. You've had all out war, and you're still going to have a big bear population, especially with something like this.
How
are the grizzlies not arranged
there? I wonder how
it is. Did they just keep up? No, never seen any great increase in the grizzly bear. You find a few here and there in the grizzly bear country. Over on the north slope there, probably a few more bears there than there is in most places now, and over in them British mountains over there, where they put in the wildlife refuge. That's quite a busy country over there. The grizzly bears don't get thick like black bears, you know, because I guess it's takes too much country to support one of them. They eat a tremendous amount of food when they eat. I guess in a lot of days they don't eat, but when they get down to it, they put away a lot of grub.
Tell me, in that refuge,
it's
polar bears came
in about
do the refuge
in Southwest. Well, I never seen a polar bear in there, but I don't know why they wouldn't be in there, because they'd fly down to the coast there, you know. Yeah, they'd be very likely polar bears to go in there, all right. I've seen polar bears over at Cockadoo, 60 miles inland, you know. Not very often, but there was some where you see them. And up at Wainwright, too.
They don't think any of the bear
populations in danger anymore. Well, I don't know. The grizzly bear, that's a different thing, you know. They can, they're getting to work pretty hard on them, really. You know, we used to drive near the Grand Eve and see several bears. Well, the last few times that day, down there, I didn't see any bears. Or grizzlies. And outside, the hunters are taking a hold of them, you know. This is about the only place in the summer I've had a most Columbia now, where there is a bear.
If I didn't name Columbia, how did the deer get along in northern Maine, you know?
Yeah, they have their ups and downs. They get into the deep snow and a big population of deer, and some of them die from starving. But they come back very quickly, though. Yeah, awful. 6 feet, maybe two in common, in places.
Well, how cool is it that they are? If they go here?
No, it's not their country. No, it gets down to 50 below that cold, and not a factor, I don't think, so much as back there, wherever you see deer, is cedar, especially when they're feed, see? Cedar? We buy from cedar trees, you know. And there's no doubt that things up here that they could subsist on, but the roads get them up here. They wouldn't last on them. Too helpless and small.
Yeah,
why
is there
reading after you left the commission, right? Yeah, I think that's why I'm reading. I'm not too far in 4 years, and then
you
know, after that I was on my
own.
No, I wasn't based anyway when I was flying on my own. I was flying government contract mostly, but I did fly down the evening in the winter time. Trappers and by over. I found out flying trappers was a pretty rough game.
Do you think the game has any about the future, the game in the last
year, is it
going to have any,
you know, do you
keep on reducing the numbers,
or is it going to have to just keep on reducing the numbers? No, I don't think you'll ever see a big herd of caribou ever again. Well, this one's in the hog, you know. You remember years ago, I got on the up to the little road we had then. And the caribou would start to cross, and for an hour or two, you'd have to stop and wait. The caribou wouldn't pay any attention to you. They'd fall all around your car, and break your windshield, and gravel on it. And now, they tell me, what's the caribou come over the hill, and they see a couple of cars, and they take off right back where they come from again. Well, the railroad, and the highways, and these high-powered cars, and motorboats, and airplanes, are just too much for them, that's all.
Well,
I take it that one of the last is this resource.
Keep it going
as possible again. That's right. But I think history is repeating itself out of the air. We all know the pattern. Everybody knows the pattern. You've got your irresponsible hunters, and you've got good hunters, and you've got good sportsmen. But amongst them is a whole bunch of irresponsible guys, and you take a bunch of them that are real good guys and real responsible guys in around town, you know. They get a gun in their hand and a pocket full of ammunition and get them out there, and then there'd be bunches of caribou, and they're just wild.
Well,
they do things that you don't know what makes them do it. Can't figure it out. And the only way you can stop that would be to have a game warden go with each one of them if they're subscripted to that disease. I don't think we'll ever see one big under the cowboy ever again.
Well, there should be more effort.
Yeah, I think that well, the wolves get sick like they do up in the trap up there. They get out of hand, and they just clean up everything. I think they should be kept down. I've been seeing them up there in flocks of 40 and 50, you know. Nothing to see a band of 20 odd wolves. And right there at Hughes, in the park up there, the headquarters of the wolves is Indian Mountain. And they start out from Indian Mountain, they cross the pass up to the north end of Indian Mountain, they go into Hog River, then they go down into the flats, and there's a big moose pasture down in there, and they're very warm, and they cross through that, and they cross the pass up again about 50 miles, 40 miles below in the mountain, south of the mountain, they make that big circle and right back into the mountain. And they do that about every 2 weeks. Big band of them. And if you ever see anything wicked, you want to see a bunch of wolves killing a moose or a cowboy. A moose festival and take quite a lot of killing for a moose. They just tie them all to pieces and eat them while the moose is still wandering around and fighting. Many of them, they go all day long. They take what they want out of them, eat a few hungry anyway. They kill them for fun, you know, and they eat a little bit. Eat a big hole in them and go on with my eye. And I see some of them live for 48 hours, checked on them. I see places and bump off and see them myself. I just didn't want to see them suffering. And the places I put my eye on, I keep watching them. They live 24, 40 hours, die a little later. But they tear a great big junk right off on them, you know, and I saw, it turned out to be 14 wolves killing a big old cow. They'd already killed a calf. And I saw them when they jumped the cow, she was fighting back because she thought that her calf might be still alive, I guess. She'd make no attempt to get away. And they just tore off great big strips of hide and just threw them out onto the snow. And afternoon, you could see their back bones going like that when they were wrenching on them hide, on the strips of hide. And I took them 10 minutes to kill our old cow, and they didn't eat her after they killed her. I don't know, pieces. Then they sent to a very sad end. I got dinner hungry and sitting over there. And the wolves were all on top of the old cow, and I didn't get a chance to count them because they were all piled up, you know. I went over there the next morning, and it was 14 wolves. I got the whole bunch. It was off in a big open jack spruce flat, you know, just a jack spruce in there. And I went over the next day after they got on, and I said, oh, boy, this is like a dog-run battle for a pool of blood all over the storm, all down, you know. And really looked wicked. But they got over on their moves. There was always a pair of hunters, you know, that should have kept them in business. They went into the state or somebody should have kept themselves in business, because they couldn't keep themselves in business. But that guy stuck on me, he'd fly under trees and around trees, and land on the top of the mountain, and Huntington, he didn't need a shotgun, all he needed was a rifle. He didn't miss anything. And he got after the wolf didn't get away from him. But they had no business around it, you know. They were both on neighbors. I've never heard of an authentic case of it in this country yet. You know, they know what happened. but I had a case with, I tell you when it really happened, it was when the game gets scarce, goodness gas, then that's when it happened, but when they were going to eat. I know the very fellow people, I know they treat Donald, one or two of them treat Donald McDonald up, putting up a tree over there at like Central one time, sitting there an hour or so. I've had them follow me. They're pretty funny about it. They keep out of sight, but you know they're following you, just to follow them. But you don't see them. I came down the Shangri-La one time from Little Squaw Lake in March with a very heavy snowfall, a breaking trail. Came to a place where the boards had crossed the Shangri-La. It's pretty wide down the valley by over. Going in one direction only. And there the trail was lagging this table, and it was just as smooth. There must have been 75 wolves crossed there, just going one way, and they just crossed there. And the dogs got up within 50 feet of that trail, and they laid down, they didn't go across it. You know that. I had to go and walk across, and then drag the dogs across there, and And you can see the wolves, you can see the wolves up all the time during daylight. I was up on the side of the hill with caribou all over everything, you know, and the wolves sitting there waiting until they got hungry. The caribou was feeding all around them, and then they kept just about 100 yards from them all the time. The wolf moved, by the caribou moved, they were all over them. I've caught two nights between Little Squaw and Shangri-La Lake Village. And I had to build a fence around the dog that night. We was coming out in the camp. Just sort of get back. They were right in there, a whole bunch of them. But they didn't come behind the best fence. And the dog wouldn't eat. The dog was sitting inside back on the lake, Shangri-La Lake Village. I was on the sled, keeping the dog out of the way.
Well,
they
eat the dog,
though. Oh, they love dog meat. Yeah, I wouldn't the dog ever come to Alaska that could handle a wolf. No, everyone ever caught me. I would kill him with one quick snap like that. Take them right off the chain, too. Yeah, that's happened right here, but it couldn't even be called halfway successful. The wolf is not made to work. They're not booked to work. They got no chest on them, or legs, or long, and limber. They need for speed. And that disposition they got, they didn't get any work out of a disposition like that. The only thing left they can only get you to see the pants and make two of them, the first chance they get.
What's the biggest wolf you've ever seen, Sam?
Gosh, I don't know. I seen some awful big ones. I think it was 50 pounds. I really let me go. I shot 5.2. I get up quite a few that you like out of shooting wolves. And they're so cruel and sad, you know, but of course I don't like them looking in the face when they're after I wounded one of them. They got an awful pair of eyes to look at. Oh, okay. Krishna too, come on now. Looking down there. But I haven't seen any on Woodland Herd now for quite a number of years because I haven't been in that particular part of the country when the caribou were there. But they used to be quite common, you know, pretty much all through the interior. You've been in there every now and then. Now, what they see them mostly around, when you see them around here, it's a little Arctic, barren ground caribou. Yeah, there's a pretty fair-sized herd on the Arctic slope in the summer. And they come on down into the Summon's Depth, and some of them come on down through the mountains to the Kobuk and the Norpak. And for 6 or 8 years, for about 8 years, there wasn't a caribou seen on the kayak book, except right up to their head in the mountains. But years ago last fall, they started coming back, and a whole bunch of them came in through the hills there, over the, we didn't look at it a second time from what we'd seen in the old days, you know, because it was only a small fraction. But they come back there in their own hues. There used to be a bunch of wintered down here trees in Tamina, right back along the hot springs around there. There used to be about 1,500 winter there. And then they've all gone. We've been around for years, haven't seen any in there. Then the Malaysia and the Tahoe, there was lots of caribou wintered in there. But they're not there. They don't see any of them. It may be that they would come through from the Kubak and the Norpak. A few years ago, they may spread out and populate that country again. But never like it was the way we used to see it. You know, remember the big herd that went through there and big giant rapids?
Yeah,
it was a whole mountain. Several mountains. The ground is alive. And they didn't destroy all the feet. They ate their feet and kept on going. They were moving, you know. They had a lot of caribou feet. You could see trails that looked like a farmer had been up that pine. And then the trails in between, there were tracks all right, but there was a whole lot of caribou feet left there yet. But the railroad and the highway and the farms and make up the migration route, and the caribou's breeding instinct is tied directly into his migration. And when he stops migrating, he stops breeding. You find that out down in Minnesota. You find it out in Maine, too. Maine used to have a big herd of caribou. Minnesota, you find the last caribou was seen in Maine in 1901. You had a big herd out there. And here, 15, 20 years ago, a hunter up in the Red Lake District in Minnesota, he shot a fruit deer. And he was very proud of it. He brought it in there, brought it about, and he had to go in there and throw it in there. There were caribou. They went up there and they found 12 caribou isolated. And they were dying off. They were very young ones. They weren't breeding because they weren't migrating. They tried to save them. They found, very conscious there, empty culture, it was terrible. Didn't tell them though. So that's what you got here now. They're making up their migrations, the migrations are changing. You've seen caribou go right through the town for a while in the migration. I've seen them go across the field and tie up that plane traffic an hour or two or more. But you don't see that anymore. And he had a big delta. The wood sometimes was whispering away, and it was just a lie there on both sides of the road. You don't see that anymore.
Well, these
reindeer
herds
have
gone into the caribou
herds, you see caribou. Yeah. Well, you see caribou, you see reindeer strains amongst all of the caribou herds in the last 1 hour. And that wasn't good for the caribou either, you know. Because the cows had a caribou picked up a lot of diseases from the reindeer. The reindeer was a semi-domesticated caribou to begin with, you see. And during that semi-domestication, he fell off of diseases that he didn't fall off of in the wild. When they died over here, they were When I saw the whole damn thing developing like from scratch.
You said it took
about
the early flying.
Did
you learn to fly here?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I apparently too.
Yeah.
Yeah. I never went to flying school.
Yeah.
Well, actually, I never did learn how to fly. No, I never went to flying school.
What years? What planes
were
you flying?
Oh, I started on the Golden Eagle on a plane that was practically a coffin without a lid on it. That was 1928. 1929, I ditched that. And I bought a Swallow. That was a good airplane. Of course, open cockpit, you know, cold. I was pretty spooky in those days, and I put on a good flying suit, and I could stand just 3 hours at 40 below on that thing, and then I had to quit. No matter where I was, I had to come down. I was just jumping right up and down. No, no way. Yeah. I bet a lot of solo, though. I'm no doggone busy. So that was good training, all right.
Well,
then
you flew as part of your job with the game commission.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You flew from area to area.
Yeah.
Did they have any other
flying
game
commission? No, they didn't approve of what I was doing. I don't know what the score was. I didn't know. Trying to figure out whether they wanted the work done or if they didn't want it done. But I would have done it anyway. And I got some pretty caustic letters from them. But finally, I decided that that wasn't for me. Maybe not a game one, but I lived there 5 years. That's it. Well, I don't know. There were a lot of them, all right. There was plenty left, you know, but some days put in 10 or 11 hours, 9 hours. I was working with bad weather, worrying, anxious moment. But, you know, when you're too busy to be scared while you're doing it, and then when you get on the ground, no use to be scared about it, so. But there was a lot of, One of the I remember taking it, I went from here to Platinum, the freight ship. Got here in the morning, down to Platinum, well, that's about 600 miles down there. It was right there in the breakup, of course, I was in freight. And the Kuskokwim was over its bank, and I saw sled trails on the ice down at Bethel that was made up at McGrath. And there was no place to land. All of that water, you know, there was no place to land, because, you know, all you could do is sit there. There was nobody there. You couldn't get to a town, because the town was on the river, and the river was all full of ice, you know.
You did your first direction?
Yeah. Took all day.
Took
all day. But I wound up at Patton that night, and the next morning I was at work. Well, Pat, man, I don't even want to talk about it. I don't want to see it. But all that good country on the water, that's not for me. There's too many moose and too many animals live there. You got to have them quiet so they got no home at all. That's going to be another death knell for the game. Because now they're going to go. That's all country country now. From there on, you're up in the barren hills. That ain't nothing. And this farm business, you know, it's this farm, everyone now rock and tough and hard work and all, lots of humorous incidents. None of them struck me funny in any of the other, I don't know, probably wasn't any funny in lots of the way, but I was in there, came back to Hughes from Maryland. And radio was very poor. And I heard a radio station trying to get over a message that I couldn't pick it up. And he was trying to get the message. And Mrs. James, radio operator, and she's very good about picking things out of the air. And she had a hard time to get this. Well, I just shut the radio off and put Duncan to the fire, and I figured she'd have it when I got there. It was an emergency, all right. But couldn't tell where it was, or what it was. Well, up here, it found out that what she had got fragments of the message over there, and what she had put together there, so, man and a half down, need medical aid, same time. And I was a million, I knew, and I didn't know anybody could get half ground. I thought we were down, we weren't ground, but anyway, emergency. Went in some gas, and I took off to this village. Took about an hour to get there. I landed, they brought this young Indian out in a sleeping bag. I even had to have a sleeping bag in the airplane. There were moose grease and bear fat in it and candle dripping. Well, I figured he was horizontally vertical, and they couldn't get back, but there was one Indian up there, so I needed to let him have to lay down. Okay. So I got out, I took out the seat, laid him down in the plane, you know, and I was trying to figure out what a half man, half down man ought to look like. It didn't look like he'd half down, but there was something wrong with him. So I put my map over there, the one that he had to lie down. I said, you get in here now and you go to town on him and take care of this guy. I said, nope. So he jumped in. In about an hour and 15 minutes, he was at town on him, and when I got within radio distance, I was calling and I heard the doctor there, and he and the nurse were down to the field of the ambulance. And I didn't know anything about this patient yet. I didn't know what to come here. He was never knew. So I had the ball, and the doctor stuck his head in and he said, can he walk? Well, I didn't know. I looked at him. And I said, no. And he says, his legs hurt, but now he can't walk. His legs hurt? No. Well, then he can walk to the ambulance. And I said, bring that in the pants. So they put him on the stretcher and led him into the ambulance. He was not bothered now, you know. So the doctor says to me, he says, put it on, Hals, we're going to go back to his lungs. And send him back to you, maybe. And I was turning up there, they went to pass for a terminal, turning around, having a cup of coffee, and visiting with some friends, and telephone rang, and the doctor says, tell him to go home. He says, this fellow shot in the hip with a gunshot. I got to keep him there. But they won't tell him anybody. Oh, I started in with that Golden Eagle and I wound up right next to the Swallow biplane. And I graduated to the Simpsons and the Curtis Wagons and the Thrushes and the Blankers, Fairchild 71s and 24s, and there was a few others, Pilgrims. Huh? Blanker. CH-400. Best Dick Blanker ever made.
Look at land and
take
off on quite a short
field,
wasn't it?
Well, they had performance, yeah. I mean, they were easy to drive around on the ground, you know, either bottom way you wanted to. Turn around, get a great performance. Every part of the airplane was an airfoil, you know. The fuselage was an airfoil, it packed its own weight. And the struts packed their weight. They were an airfoil. That left the wing to carry the load. They were slow and very precise. Just as accurate as shooting a gun, yeah. They knew. And you could land in the same track all day long and just as many times you wanted to.
Did they have enough power for
that? Yeah, they had plenty of power. Yeah, that was the senior pacemaker. That Lewis and Carroll happened in the CH-400, too. It's unbelievable. They leave a payload in about, probably 900 pounds. Well, when contract them, survey contract, they were involved in the most interesting plan I ever did. And I put in a good many years of that, both of the geological and the geodetics, and then the Army Air Corps geodetics. Both of those, yeah, but in the other time I did some ski work for the geodetics, the Army geodetics. You see, the map of Alaska didn't exist up until about 10 years ago. There hadn't even hardly a skeleton of a map of Alaska. You had a map, all right, but you try to go to some place on it and use it for what a map is supposed to be, and you'd wind up anywhere from 16 to 35 miles out away from the place you want to go to. And now you're closer to the map was. Some place is closer. Well, when the Army come up here during the war, World War II, they were leaving planes all over that. We knew about that. They were pilots at last. They were used to radio waves, you know. They had a different system of navigation than we had up here. And they couldn't do that because we hadn't radio waves here enough time. And that drainage line, they didn't understand that at all. And they didn't know the drainage was anyway. And they were getting lost all over, and they had a crash program to straighten out the map of Alaska so they could navigate. And what they did, they had to shoot the stars, you see. And in the summertime up here, you can't shoot the stars, so that was a wintertime job. And they had to come up there, and they had a big map of Alaska with them, and all these places named on it, like Cairo and Zenitai and a bunch of other places, and they were in here. Hotels there. So when they asked me how about the accommodations of this hotel, that hotel up on Black River, I went in with a traffic cabin, and there was no accommodations at all. Well, what are we going to do? Well, we're going to sleep in a tent. Oh, not me! No. That tent up there, part of the world, I know. But they did. You know that? And it's pretty comfortable in tents, you know. You get the 8 to 10 wall tent, close over, you can stay, and they couldn't work. Theoretically, they could work down to 40 below, but actually, when it panned out 33 below, they could work their instruments in because the mercury would chew up into a little ball, you know, and they had a pool of mercury, the stars committee. Well, then the only way they had these points marked on the map where they wanted these star shots. And there were no names. It was also top secret business with no names there, and they had numbers. And the numbers were wrong in nearly all instances. And you look on the map, and the numbers were all mixed up, you know. But I would do that, and I would have to know which place we'd gone to because I'd been to that lake before. And I could recognize them in the picture. They had pictures taken from 20,000 feet. And I could recognize those lakes. And they wouldn't believe me. And they'd run their way over to Canada. No, that ain't the lake. That ain't the lake. It's far east. Well, I'd try to. I could use up gasoline and not go over there and get back here. So I'd climb over to where the Canadian line went off through the Pinto. I said, you're going to be bigger than Canada? No, you don't want to go to Canada. And I said, there's the Canadian line right there. You know, I said, let's turn back and go where I want to go. So you get out and get on that lake. And I said, look around here. See if you can make that picture fit this lake. That's why I decided maybe it would. So they'd set up their instruments and stars would come right in. And the minute they then they knew it was a lake. But we went to Shelly Lake up in the Arctic there, and that was a different thing. I see him so well. There's no wood up there, nothing, you know. And that lake was 35 miles out east and west and 15 miles out north and south. And I told him about that. They were making up the stylus and butter. And I said, you don't want to make up the stylus. That way, I said, it's in the map. I said, that's no good. He's got 35 miles out east and west and 15 miles out north and south. But they made up the stylus anyway, and the next day we went up there. And we had a briefing day and a briefing night that night. And we could have got down. But they never got one star into the pool at all. And so the next morning, there was a howling blizzard like you never had before in your life, and you stick your head out of the tent, and you're like sticking it in a bowl of milk. And you sat there for 14 days. They knew about how they were in the same position, and there they were. And then they got the star left from that position, and the next, and the good day came, and the star rolled right into the pool right in a minute. And that got it. From then on, they didn't question me at all.
And when did that
baby
really start
us when I had
to do it?
After
World War II.
Somewhere in
there. They got a, they call us, unit, admin, special tribe. Where did that really come from, the coast
from? Some of the nomads.
Sure.
They were the first one I was in Fort Yukon in 1927. And I got acquainted with old Elijah Petunia there. I got acquainted with most of them. They couldn't talk any English in those days, you know. But old Elijah Petunia, he's an old buck now, but he was a young buck then. And he was blocked and he was afraid, and he was wild as a caribou. But he never took each other, you know. And I got, they had the, they come down at Fort Yukon, down to Phoenix. They pushed the camps a mile out of town. And they wouldn't fraternize the natives or white men either. And they had, they had about 20 dogs per person now. It was a big thing for them. And they pitched the dogs in the room right around the camp so nobody could get in there. Boy, you couldn't get by them dogs. They'd take a leg right off of that. Even the Indians couldn't get in. They didn't stop in that car. They stayed there 2 weeks with 65 below. They were living in skin tents. Even on the stove, they were in the rock luxury because they had wood to burn. They never seen nothing like that before, you know. They ain't suffering no hardships at all. Skin cancers. All they did, and they didn't need no food. They had 200 white fox skins with them. And that was the year Phil was king, you know, 27, 28. And the traders, they tried to buy them fox skins. They didn't find them. And when they got ready to go, back to the Arctic, Elijah, he comes at me, and the sign language, why, and he went to the MC store and he swapped two fox skins for ammunition, tobacco, and tea. That's all he wanted. Meat was the rest of it. He had meat passed all along the way. And he went back to the Arctic. And now, every time I go down a few pass, I can't stop. I have a ceremonial dinner with Elijah in his life. Huh?
Ten women
were on the thing. Oh, yes, part of them. Not like the Yukon women.
I think
writing before the shooting, they have eyes in them. Mm-hmm. I don't know how
I had
that. I didn't look on the bottom of the thing. But Elijah, he's quite a guy, you know. He's a really, 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 you know him, I guess, okay?
Not really.
Yeah, well, she's the slimmest, longest, leanest Eskimo woman I ever see. And when you have a, when Elijah and I have a banquet, why, it's fried caribou meat and pepper and salt and tea. That's what it is. The old lady, she stands over the Yukon stove and wiggles at a podium now, you know. And she fries the caribou meat and she's got a long cigarette holder and a cigarette sticking way out here and the ashes dropping in the pan. It's good. The atmosphere, you know. And then Elijah, he gets out his, he's got a roll of greasy paper there, brown paper, tied up the stove. He unrolls that, and that he's got pictures he's taken in 1927 or so people, him and I and the camp. So we have to look at them again.
Well,
where
did they live originally?
They lived there, they lived here in the coast, you know, but they went back inland there to get away from the influx of white people. Half a dozen traders around, so. And then Foxkins, the reason they didn't want to sell that money, they didn't know what money was, and they didn't want any money. If they had $10 bills, they'd probably be lighting a fire with it, you know, so you want to kill them. they could trade them for cow or for rice or toast there, those traders that were not cow or something. And that's the only thing they knew. They knew that they could they knew that they'd get certain things for fur, but they didn't know they could get that same thing for money.
Oh, they caught it
in Indians. No, they shot it in Indians, they said. Just now, I think they're not camp, they're not after cow. But they're tougher than wire. They had no place to be buried. They lived all the way from the church to the hula hula. Back and forth, back to the game, they had to move because they didn't have nothing to eat but game, you know. And fish. When the game got shot, they only had to fish. Well, they could eat fish for a month, but then after a month, the fish got pretty tiresome to them. They admitted that themselves. And when they got back out of jail, that was fine. They didn't need nothing else. So in 42, I was trying to wait for the army party. And they were camped at the city of the lake, all over down below the lake, about 5 miles. So I was camped, you couldn't see it. They were in the snowbanks. They were living in the snowbanks. There's no wood down there, it was too early. The whole gang of them had built about one little fire day. They had green willows tied up in little bundles and about that long. And there was nobody in the area but Eskimos to set their own fire and make them wood. And they'd boil one kettle of water and make tea. Once a day. And they live under the snowbanks. And before they camp and went back up to the lake, up there, and they took that tent and that company here for about 2 hours. And they hadn't seen no money. So 2 hours, here comes a big dog team, Tommy Pontiac, Elijah Christina, and David Pia. They had coffee made for them, and they started drinking coffee. And they were eating cupcakes. That's when I hope they read the dog for a long time now. But they had a lot of fur. So they asked me if I would take this fur in Fairbanks farm, and I went in, and it happened that I was going in. For 2 days, because I had some damage to the tail of the airplane. Close to it. And I was going in and I was coming back to the lake. Well, they took off what we thought was about $700 worth of fur. They weren't that much groceries. 1,100 pounds, what I can haul. And the army boy told me to haul it in for us for nothing, because I was in the chatter anyway, I wasn't really paying for it. But then I took that fur into the NC. And last office kept looking at it. And it was such good grade, they turned all the old $1,000 worth of fur there. Well, we thought there was only 700. No, they don't rub it there, you know, because there's no dust on one thing. Beautiful dust on. I got this job and I didn't come for that much, so I was trying to give them credit for this thing. So we went put this stuff on the books and we found they already had a $500 credit there. And they didn't know about it. They'd send in a bunch of fur by Sig Reed. And they would overshot them out, too. If they send in a bunch of fur, they'd get back a load of grub. As far as they're concerned, that's it. The transaction is made. So, right there. So I got back, I took the bill and credit slip and everything I could think of back to them. And I spent hours trying to explain to them. Couldn't get it at all. I used the grub out there and Fox Skin would turn them in and they didn't want them anymore.
Well,
I tell you, you can't go up in the places and measure the stars and the finger bones of those people, you know. And do scientific work to say one and all over the country. You gotta have them nailed down somewhere you can hold them.
What did they burn for fuel?
Oh, willows, when they get it.
Back
and sometimes they'd come to a little coal hole and they'd take the coal cutters 5 pounds of coal out, put it in a little sack, you know. And with one little man of that coal about that big, they'd boil quite a coffee or a tea, you know. They had it. Oh, yeah, you want to lie up there. You want to look up and like this?
I wasn't right there,
though. You heard that? Yeah. I put that name here. I know, I didn't put the name on it, but I was a car that was good enough. I want to tell you, I was very afraid of wolves. And we had a lot of camp, and there was a lot of wolf dropping down there, so I cut off and shit, but he stuck it in the wolf, and the wolf dropped in. I showed him this pillow, and he thought they beat up somebody. He didn't stay to see him out, he got out of there. So I rolled the wolf button right.
We've got about a minute left on the tape. Is there anything you want to say in closing remarks?
No, I can't think of anything more. I think I covered it pretty good.
I want to thank Tom for his kindness for coming down here and telling how much you enjoyed this. And we hope you'll come down and join us all again.
Well, I think I better thank you all for sitting here listening to me, too.
Yeah,
but
Sam, I feel we've only got half of it.
Yeah,
I'm
going
to have to get him here again.
Well, you know, there's 23 years of that fire, and then
we
got about 1 month of it, I guess.
Yeah.
That's just what I thought. We have some coffee and cookies now.